on Iranian embassies and the West's support for riots. The spokesman being Nasser Kanani said the assaults on the Islamic Republic's embassies in Europe are connected to the West's political support for rioters in Iran. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman made the remarks in reaction to recent attacks on Iran's embassies in certain European countries. Today, in a grave security accident in our embassy in Copenhagen, an assailant tried, unfortunately failed, to stab our ambassador, who happens to be a woman, Kanani tweeted in reaction to attack on the Iranian embassy in Denmark and some diplomatic missions elsewhere in Europe. Tehran Times reads, Iran informs Iraq it won't tolerate terrorism from Kurdistan region. The Islamic Republic would not allow continuous acts of aggression against itself by terrorist organizations based in Iraqi Kurdistan, Iran's foreign minister has told his Iraqi counterpart. During a phone conversation with Fuad Hussein, Hossein Amir Abdullahian said, we will not tolerate the continuation of aggression and terrorist acts by groups that have taken refuge in the Kurdistan region of Iraq and target Iran's national security. To protect Iran's border, the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, IRGC, has struck terrorist strongholds in northern Iraq with drones and artillery. As for the JCPOA, Tasnim News makes a reference to it. Recent talks on JCPOA revival progressive, Iran's FM says. In a phone call, Amir Abdullahian and the EU's foreign policy chief Josep Borrell discussed the issue of the ongoing negotiations aimed at the removal of US sanctions against the Islamic Republic. The Iranian foreign minister described as progressive the recent talks held in New York and Vienna concerning the issue of the sanctions and revival of the 2015 nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. That'll be it for the news section. About 80% of anti-Iranian tweets in the last 3 weeks were by newly created robots that do not have more than 10 followers. Most of them are directed from outside Iran, especially by European countries.
The Independent had an investigation about online trolls and cyber networks, which found out 90% of Persian accounts active on Twitter are fake and have been created for cyber warfare. It doesn't actually reflect opinions of the Iranian public. This is really interesting because anti-Iran media keep bragging that we're talking about the Iranian public and their opinion, but 90% of them are referencing fake accounts.
Last year, Facebook removed hundreds of fake accounts linked to a troll farm in Albania that it said were linked to the MEK. Facebook describes troll farms as a physical location where a collective of operators share computers and phones to jointly manage a pool of fake accounts as part of an influence operation. A past report by Al Jazeera has revealed some of the hidden world of the MEK camp in Albania. According to this report, MEK has established a Twitter troll factory, which has up to 1,500 members tweeting in support of regime change against Iran.
The MEK had taken arms in 1981 and killed every child and bearded man who looked like a follower of the Islamic Revolution, but now they are operating in the cyberspace with the same tenacity through fake accounts. They try to demolish one's reputation if they speak out against the MEK. Back then, if you disagreed their beliefs, they would shoot a bullet in your head, but today they commit the same assassination through fake accounts.
Al Jazeera interviewed two former MEK members in Tirana. One described how several thousand accounts are managed by about 1,000 to 1,500 MEK members. It is all very well organized and there are clear instructions about what needs to be done. Another said, our orders would tell us the hashtags to use in our tweets in order to make them more active. According to the report, the people behind this activity relied on a combination of authentic and fake accounts to post MEK-related content and comment on their own and other people's posts, including those of international news organizations like Radio Liberty, Voice of America, and BBC.
Online trolls generally operate in two categories. One of them is establishing credibility. A group of fake accounts create popularity for a certain account and make it a social factor. A clear example of this was in 2018 when the MEK used trolls to establish credibility for an account called Hikmat Alavi. It became such a credible public factor that contributed to major outlets like the Wall Street Journal and The Hill. What's interesting is that this person did not even exist in the real world. Another tactic they use is massacring the prestige and character of the owner of an account. They create campaigns that aim to socially defame a person through social media.
As part of the recent protests in Iran, the two main websites of the Iranian government and several media websites have been targeted by hackers claiming to be from Anonymous. Apparently, thousands of amateur hackers have organized online to orchestrate cyber attacks on Iranian officials and institutions, as well as share tips on how to get around curbs on internet access by using privacy-enhancing tools.
Hackers are usually those who can use their knowledge in social media and the cyberspace to enter warfare. Based on our experience with hackers, especially in political issues, we are certain some governments are behind this issue. There are hackers that are assisted and supplied by hostile governments with both hardware and software. So we can clearly see their strings being pulled by those governments who don't want Iran and its current government.
Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia, a country that shows zero tolerance for criticism of its absolute monarchy, as underlined by the murder of Khashoggi, the Saudi dissident journalist, has been setting up media organizations in other languages promoting free speech, particularly about the Islamic Republic of Iran. The Iranian Foreign Ministry has summoned Britain's ambassador to Tehran to express Tehran's protest over hostile attempts by London-based Persian-language television channels, which have fiercely sought in recent days to provoke violent protests and incite deadly riots against the Iranian government and public.
The BBC had a clear role in the 2009 conspiracy, and it ran several campaigns like the Phoenix, which involved the case of Neda Aghasultan, where they faked her killing. They also fabricated the Tarane Mousavi story. It's interesting that by the will of God, the lies in each project were exposed very soon. BBC Persian kept claiming that Tarane Mousavi had been arrested by the Islamic Republic of Iran and has been raped and her body has been scorched. Later, it was revealed that two reporters fabricated this narrative who worked for Radio Farda, and BBC Persian now have released a statement saying that everything they said about Tarane Mousavi was a lie. So you see, that's how BBC Farsi operates as a leader for the other anti-revolutionary media outlets.
It was also stated that such bids amount to interference in Iran's internal affairs and violate the country's national sovereignty. To quote,
15 years ago, an American researcher said 50 international companies are active across various media platforms. But a few years later, they merged together, and now only 5 international companies own most international outlets. There's a book called Who Owns the Media by 2 American authors, which goes over the issue in details. Data gathered about the shareholders of these transnational corporations revealed that they are mostly owned by Zionists.
London has become a hub of such Iranian channels in exile. Some media experts have suggested that Iran International TV has turned into a platform for encouraging ethnic partisanship and sectarianism. In the past, Ofcom has scrutinized Iran International for giving airtime to the spokesperson of a group that praised a terrorist attack in Iran. That's all for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after. And bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, power companies are to face a windfall tax after Prime Minister Liz Truss was accused of another screeching U-turn, having previously rejected calls to impose a levy. Stay with us as we look at the British media's coverage of this story. British newspaper The Independent has more on this story. Business Secretary Jacob Rees-Mogg has launched plans for a cap on revenues of low-carbon electricity generators in what effectively amounts to a temporary windfall tax on the sector's profits. The Labour Party said Prime Minister Liz Truss has been dragged kicking and screaming into the U-turn after months of resisting its calls for further levies on the extraordinary profits being made by the electricity-generating companies. Reports suggest that the cap could limit prices to as little as £50 to £70 per megawatt hour, compared to current prices of around £500, with the government taking as much as 90% of the wholesale revenues above this level. Jacob Rees-Mogg's business department declined to confirm figures, which are subject to consultation. But they said the scheme had the potential to save billions of pounds for British bill payers, while allowing electricity generators to cover their costs plus receive an appropriate revenue. But industry body Renewable UK said that, as designed, the scheme would mainly impact on older wind and solar energy projects, but voiced concern that it could skew future investment towards fossil fuel energy sources. Renewable UK's Chief Executive Officer, Dan McGrail, said, "We are concerned that a price cap will send a wrong signal to investors in renewable energy in the United Kingdom. A price cap acting as a 100% windfall tax on renewables revenue above a certain level, while excess oil and gas profits are taxed at 25%, risks skewing investment towards the fossil fuels that have caused this energy crisis. This decade, we need to attract £175 billion of investment in secure domestic wind power, and we can already see the investor turmoil that the European Union's proposed price cap is causing in the European market. To limit the negative impacts, it is essential that a cap is set at a level that doesn't make the United Kingdom less attractive to investors than the European Union, and is technology neutral and has a clear sunset clause in place. Ministers have been looking for means to rein in unprecedented profits being made from nuclear and wind power and solar energy, which result from the fact that their prices are tied to gas, which has rocketed in price as a result of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Prime Minister Liz Truss has previously resisted Labour's call for an extension to the windfall tax imposed by former Chancellor Rishi Sunak on North Sea oil and gas producers, insisting that any such levy would deter future investment. Britain's Guardian newspaper has more on this story. Renewable power companies will have their revenues capped in England and Wales after the government bowed to pressure to clamp down on runaway profits. The announcement, late on Tuesday night, 11th of October, provoked immediate accusations that Downing Street had performed another screeching U-turn, having previously rejected calls to impose a windfall tax on electricity-generating power companies. On the leadership trail, Liz Truss repeatedly resisted calls to cap huge profits being generated by power companies after Boris Johnson's government imposed a £5 billion windfall tax on oil and gas companies in May, taking a slice of their profits. The business department said it was stepping in with a temporary cost-plus revenue limit for renewable and nuclear electricity generators in England and Wales. This will curb the amount generators can make, allowing generators to cover their costs plus receive an appropriate revenue, and will come into force at the start of next year. The detail was contained in the government's new energy prices bill, which limits power prices for households at an average of £2,500 a year and is estimated will cost taxpayers about £89 billion. It has been estimated that taxing electricity generators such as wind and solar farms could raise between £3 and £4 billion to help offset some of this cost. Ed Miliband, the Shadow Climate and Net Zero Secretary, said the government has finally accepted the principle of Labour's call for a windfall tax on excess profits of electricity generators. After months of telling the country they were utterly opposed to the principle of a windfall tax, they have been dragged kicking and screaming to implement it. Yet again, this shows the Labour Party leading the agenda in British politics with another screeching U-turn from a government in office but not in power. But the government's delay in acting will have cost billions of pounds and the public will pay the price. Prime Minister Liz Truss ruled out a windfall tax on electricity generators when vying with Rishi Sunak to become Prime Minister, calling it a Labour idea and all about bashing business, and it sends the wrong message to international investors and to the public. She reinforced her stance when announcing her household bills package last month, saying, "I believe it is the wrong thing to be putting companies off investing in the United Kingdom." But after reversing plans to scrap the top rate of tax last week, Liz Truss's decision to limit profits at renewable power companies will be seen as another sign of weakness. The government has been accused by institutions including the International Monetary Fund of making the Bank of England's cutting inflation job harder. Mortgage rates soared along with government borrowing costs after Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng's disastrous mini-budget last month. An industry source said, "This is another U-turn and it's a 100% of windfall tax from the people that said they would never do it." The business department argues that the measure differs from a windfall tax as it will be applied to excess revenues generators are receiving rather than applying to all of their profits. The Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy said renewable power generators have been benefiting from abnormally high prices because of the link between soaring gas prices and wholesale electricity prices since the start of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Low-carbon electricity generators are therefore benefiting from abnormally high prices, while consumers are having to pay significantly more for energy generated from renewables and nuclear power, even though they often cost less to produce. The government said the limit would be a temporary measure to deal with the exceptional market conditions driven by high global gas prices. the decision to impose a cap on revenues earned by renewable power companies such as wind and solar power operators follows months of wrangling between the government and industry.
Say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witching.
Stand here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Democracy, it depends on people voting. Voting depends on people being informed. And the press, it's here to keep the people informed, right? Very simple. But there's a problem. People in the U.S. do not trust the media. The news is questioned, doubted, and not believed by millions of people, and that is a challenge for democracy.
In media, we don't trust.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. In this episode, we'll discuss growing distrust among Americans toward the media. We're now in a place where people do not trust the news, where people do not know where to find the news, and what to think of it when they finally do find it. So, how did we get here? What impact does the media distrust have on American society? And what is it about the media that now many people distrust? As usual, we're pleased to have our two guests on our show, Ben Norton, an independent journalist and editor of Multipolarista, who's joining us from Managua, Nicaragua, and Shabir Rizvi, organizer with the Party for Socialism and Liberation, who's joining us from Chicago. Stay tuned.
Trust in government, in its institutions and media is essential to the functioning of democracy in any country. Yet today, trust is declining. A recent poll by Rasmussen Reports shows that most voters believe fake news is a serious problem and don't trust the political news they get from the media.
And now 62% of likely U.S. voters think the problem of bias in the news media is getting worse. Just 10% believe the media bias problem is actually getting better. Now, this is certainly not good news. Other polls have come up with the same alarming figures. Now, let's put these numbers into some sort of perspective. What are the underlying reasons of this declining mistrust today?
Why is that? These media outlets have a long history of lying. For decades, these main media outlets have lied to sell U.S. wars, to justify regime change operations, meddling in foreign countries, and they've also lied about domestic politics. In the U.S., the media is extremely partisan. Pretty much every media outlet is firmly associated with either the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, and they usually don't publish information that can rock the boat and hurt the interests of those political parties.
So the phenomenon of the public's perception of the media has been relatively consistent for over a decade, and we're not talking about a specific period or a specific president. Americans have had trust issues with the media for many years. So how did they get here? Isn't it a bit surprising the issue of declining trust has not been resolved?
It's no surprise that people don't trust the media. The media, people are starting to wake up that, like, you know, there's a lot of special interest groups. There's a lot of mega corporations that have a huge influence on the media. And the media itself is also very partisan, right? It's no secret that CNN and MSNBC are very close to the Democrats, that Fox News is very close to the Republicans. And you also have to understand that, you know, news media here isn't even just the facts, right? It's a Google search away. The New York Times has sent, you know, its stories sometimes to the Pentagon, to the State Department to get approval. So right then and there, news media isn't even independent, right? It's very dependent on all these different groups, whether that's a corporation or an arm of the government.
The low trust is the result of years of self-inflicted wounds by the media themselves. Bias, blunders, and superficiality. And this, of course, plays into election campaigns, because when media fact-check the candidates, people don't believe them. When the media reports of the candidates, people think that they don't get the straight scoop.
And then when it comes to the election of Donald Trump in 2016, the media blamed Russia with no evidence. Of course, these false claims came from the CIA and U.S. intelligence agencies. And people, you know, after being lied to so long, they can see clearly that the corporate media outlets in the U.S. serve the economic and political interests of, one, the billionaire capitalists who own the media, and then, of course, the U.S. government itself and the political interests of the political parties that the media outlets are aligned with.
Here is a clip from President Joe Biden's speech that kind of wrap up the climate of distrust in the country. Let's watch it.
Last summer, I was in Philadelphia and I met a small business owner, a woman. I asked her, I said, "What do you need most?" Never forget what she said to me. She said, looking me in the eye, she said, "I just want the truth. The truth. Just tell me the truth." Think of that. My fellow Americans, you're owed nothing less than the truth.
People are wary of bias, fed up with getting lied to, and like the woman in Joe Biden's story, they just want the truth. They don't know how to find it, where to find it. Truth has become a rare commodity. They seem confused. The problem is that some of these lies have been very costly for the public, like the reason for the war in Iraq that led to many Americans getting killed in action.
When it comes to foreign policy, media outlets in the U.S. frequently lie and spread propaganda to justify U.S. wars of aggression. We saw this with the illegal U.S. invasion of Iraq. The media was used to spread lies about so-called weapons of mass destruction. We saw this with the NATO war in Libya in 2011. The U.S. media spread lies claiming that Muammar Gaddafi, the Libyan leader, was giving Viagra to his soldiers and encouraging them to assault women. That was completely false. The war in Syria, we saw a lot of lies with the war in Yemen, the war in Afghanistan. There are constantly lies.
And now this pattern of distrust shows a rather interesting aspect. People trust the local government more than the state government, and the state government more than the federal government. Is this pattern true when it comes to the media as well, and why is it so if that's the case?
In general, yes, you could probably say that people in the U.S. trust local and state government more than federal government, but really, even trust in local government is not much higher. And why is that? It's because at the federal level, the national level in the United States, everyone knows that people who have more money win. If you're rich, you can basically buy a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. In congressional races in the United States, more than 90% of candidates who have more money win. And the media is very similar. If you're a billionaire oligarch, if you're very wealthy, you can buy a media outlet. Jeff Bezos, the richest person on earth, who's the founder of Amazon, estimated wealth of $200 billion, he bought the Washington Post. It's his property. So in the United States, it's an ultra-capitalist society. If you're rich, you can buy the media. If you're rich, you can basically buy yourself a position in government. And that's why people don't trust these institutions.
Interestingly, we see that many Americans now say that they're losing trust on the church, the medical system, the presidency, the Supreme Court, and Congress. Public faith in each of these institutions has fallen this decade. We are now seeing people who are becoming more and more localized. Seems like they don't care about what is happening in the broader picture. They care less about the big stories, be it national or international, although some of those stories might drastically influence their lives.
The higher you go up the chain from local all the way to federal, or rather national, the more special interest groups, the more lobbies, the more people with money that you'll run into that have an influence on whether you are a politician, for example, or whether you're a major news corporation, right? Because, you know, the more people that you are able to kind of influence, you'll find more money in there, right? And so when people are saying that they trust, you know, local media more than, you know, national media, that makes sense.
Fake news. The term recalls different pictures for different people. For many, it is Donald Trump who labeled virtually anything that was against him as fake news.
Fake news. Fake, disgusting news. The fake media. And the fake news refuse to call it, right?
So for some people, it is rather spooky. For some, it has lost its meaning. But one thing is for certain, that fake news is now ubiquitous. It's everywhere. Where does this overwhelming volume of misinformation come from?
Is fake news a problem in the U.S.? Well, it exists in every country. But I think one of the reasons that there's so much fixation on fake news is because the ruling elites in the United States, the billionaire oligarchs and the politicians they fund, refuse to admit why they're unpopular. Instead, they try to blame so-called fake news. They blame Russia. They blame China. They blame Iran. The reality is that life is getting worse for average working people in the U.S. Life expectancy is decreasing. We now see that for the first time, a younger generation is having a worse life than their parents. Poverty is increasing. Homelessness is increasing. And fake news is a scapegoat. Instead of saying that people don't want to vote for these corrupt politicians because they don't do anything to make people's lives better, they say fake news is the real problem. Of course, fake news does exist. But the reality is that when we look at the corporate media is full of propaganda and disinformation. They don't call it fake news because it's serving the interests of the U.S. government.
And now ratings for cable television news, conservatives and liberals alike, went up during the Trump presidency, but the numbers plummeted under Joe Biden's presidency.
The ratings are up. It means you can't do without Donald Trump. You would be lost without Donald Trump.
Well, that CNN's, is what he says.
Ted, you know that's not true.
CNN's ratings would be in the toilet without Donald Trump.
You know that's not true. You're playing for laughs. You've lived through enough presidencies to know.
Hold on a second,
there will be more
Brian.
Presidents.
What were the ratings before Trump, and what are the ratings now?
I would say we might be up 20%. We might be up 30%. We might be up 40%. If we go back down 40%, that's okay, too.
Well, it may not be okay.
Of course it is.
The interesting thing here is that in both periods, trust was declining. So that meant they were gaining audience but losing trust. This pattern indicates that people are now looking at news as some form of entertainment. It also means that media like CNN, who dislike Trump, would be at least deep down very happy if he gets re-elected again, simply because Trump means ratings go up. And that's really strange.
Yeah, I think it mainly has to do with, you know, leaving out information or kind of giving out half-truths to things, right? It's the way they kind of frame stories that causes this misinformation, where all this misinformation happens from. You can say one thing, but leave out an entire, like, historical analysis of it that kind of frames things incorrectly, that makes people think a certain way or another.
It's one thing to hear something that isn't true. It's another to believe it. It's these beliefs that lead to action, which can have both positive and negative repercussions. After all, propaganda is only successful to the extent that it spreads. But why is it that so many people seem to get fooled by the fake news they are bombarded with?
People in the U.S. can sometimes get fooled about issues because the education system is very bad, and the media is certainly not teaching people what's actually happening. There's so much propaganda. People are brainwashed from the very day they're born to hate China, to hate Russia, to hate Iran, to hate communism, to love capitalism, to love imperialism. And also racism is a huge part of this. There's a lot of internalized racism. So when it comes to learning about other countries, there are racist stereotypes that are taught that other countries are so-called authoritarian or backward, and these so-called Western democracies are progressive and they're supporting human rights. It's a lot of propaganda, and when you, from the very day you're born, if you're just bombarded with that propaganda day in, day out, 24/7 in the media and the education system, it's very easy to deceive people and convince them with propaganda to support whatever war or aggression the U.S. empire wants to commit this week.
Now, many Americans share fake news on social media because they're simply not paying attention to whether that content is correct. Some of these false stories can be very dangerous as it causes people to change their behavior. Now, this is why medical disinformation was so concerning during the COVID pandemic. So why is it the U.S. public seems to be so ignorant regarding the facts?
Yeah, ignorant isn't the word I would use. I would use the word misinformed, to some extent even indoctrinated. From the moment Americans are born, they are subject to the most immense indoctrination campaign probably in history, right? Everything from, you know, Hollywood action movies to what they see on TV to the education Americans receive is part of this, you know, American exceptionalism, so-called exceptionalism, that is kind of hardwired into Americans at some point. And so when, you know, Americans come off as ignorant, right, it's mostly because of all of this indoctrination that they've received, and they don't have any, you know, mainstream news outlets or some formal education to kind of break them out of it.
There are a lot of partisan folks out there who don't have any interest in journalist fairness. They want their preferred media to either back their candidate or trash the other candidate or both. A Pew survey suggests that 95% of MSNBC's audience is now Democrats, while 93% of the Fox News audience is Republicans. It seems as if that instead of voters being shaped by news, news is being shaped for voters.
The media in the United States is completely polarized based on one faction of the two corporate imperialist parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. And Republicans tend to watch Republican media outlets and read Republican media outlets like Fox News or the Washington Times. And Democrats tend to watch MSNBC and read the New York Times. And that it's not new. In many countries around the world, there is this kind of polarization. But in the United States, it's extreme. These media outlets do not in any way pretend to be neutral, and they're not neutral. They're extreme propaganda, and this leads people to just basically go along with whatever media outlets they prefer.
There are two Americas now, each listening to its own preferred news sources. Two parallel public realities. People only want to watch what they already agree with.
I read stories like that all the time, too. It's very unfortunate. I think it's honestly just a testament to how much, you know, the American government does not care about education, does not care about kind of sustaining its own population, of creating like an intelligent workforce. Rather, you know, the education system here is crumbling, right? Where there's the majority of people state to state, like, you know, in urban centers, we see education funding being pulled. We see resources being pulled, and you know, all that money goes to like cops or the military.
Maybe it is hard for the ordinary people to see this destructive pattern of polarization in the media and its consequences. But what about the media outlets themselves? They're made up of people who are professional journalists, pollsters, and writers, and so on. For this, they can see this destructive pattern. So why is it that they do not try to inform the public about it and stop this kind of behavior?
We should keep in mind that these media outlets belong to billionaire capitalist oligarchs who are making money off of this. So it's not just a problem of polarization. It's a problem of the very structure of the corporate media. It's corporate. It's not about informing people. It's about making money. Informing people is secondary. The first, most important thing is making money. And you make money by serving the political interests of the U.S. State Department, of the military-industrial complex, and in one and one of the two political parties. You pick one of the parties, and you serve their interests, and you make money from it. So all of these problems are simply byproducts of the undemocratic capitalist system in the United States, in which if you're rich, you can control society. You can buy influence in the political system, you can buy the media, and you can tell people what to think.
The war in Ukraine is rather a good example of media coverage and how it shapes people's minds about what is going on. Pretty much who is winning the war in Ukraine depends on who is doing the talking. The US public is generally said that authoritarian Russia cannot be trusted with the facts, let alone the truth about the war. So we, meaning the Western media, have to be trusted to carry on the news.
The proxy war in Ukraine is a great example of the power of propaganda in the corporate media. We see that media outlets in the U.S. refuse to acknowledge facts that are undeniable. Like, for instance, the United States backed a violent coup that overthrew Ukraine's democratically elected government in 2014. That fact is conveniently left out of basically all media. Instead, corporate media outlets portray Russia as this crazy imperialist country that just wanted to invade Ukraine because Putin is supposedly evil or whatever ridiculous nonsense. They ignore the fact that the United States started a civil war in Ukraine back in 2014 and that according to the United Nations, 14,000 Ukrainians died in that Western-fueled war between 2014 and the end of 2021.
The one-sided story being told by the US media about the war in Ukraine means that anyone trying to come up with a different narrative will be simply outcast as Russia sympathizer, far left or far right fanatic.
When Russia invaded Ukraine, for example, the news media completely failed to mention why they were even there in the first place. They failed to mention, you know, the expansion of NATO eastward. For decades now, they failed to mention the U.S.-backed coup that happened 8 years ago. They failed to mention that Ukraine has been bombing the Donbass region for 8 years. But instead, what they did was they kind of framed this as like an invasion that happened for no reason, just because Russia is supposedly a bully, right?
Now, if anyone tries to underline these underreported aspects of the war and slam the policy of the U.S. and its allies towards the war, they would be labeled in the mainstream media as narrow-minded people who do not see the big picture.
The U.S. and European countries were sending billions of dollars of military assistance and weapons to Ukraine before Russia sent a single troop in on February 24th of 2022. All of that history is erased by the media. And the media portrays the conflict as a supposed battle between good and evil, democracy and authoritarianism. They don't mention that the Ukrainian regime is extremely undemocratic, that it banned opposition parties, that all socialist and communist opposition parties have been banned, that opposition media outlets in Ukraine were shut down. They don't mention any of those facts.
Another international story that is often distorted on the U.S. media is the issue of Palestine. Almost no day goes by without regime troops committing a horrible crime against Palestinians, and there is no boundary to these atrocities. Children as young as 5 are arrested and put in jail. Women and elderly are shot. Residents are forced to destroy their houses with their own hands. And yet, Israel's image has remained positive among both party groups.
The reason that there is still support among the U.S. public for apartheid Israel is because most people in the U.S. don't know anything about Israel. Apartheid Israel is simply portrayed as a democracy, even though it's not in any way a democracy. The fact that it's an apartheid regime that systematically violates the rights of Palestinians, that colonizes Palestinian land, illegally occupies Palestinian land, that's never mentioned in the media. And the reality is that many people in the United States, they only learn about this information from the media. So yes, they are propagandized. That's why they don't know what's actually happening. They get all of this propaganda spoon-fed to them through corporate media outlets that support the apartheid Israeli regime and oppose the rights of Palestinians. They don't know that the apartheid Israeli regime constantly murders Palestinian journalists and children and doctors and nurses and illegally steals and occupies their land and is committing ethnic cleansing and genocide.
Now, as a declining trust towards media shows no signs of improving, U.S. public just goes from one episode of extremism to the next. Now, there was once talk about political divisions, but it seems like now we're far past that. People are now talking about political tribalism. Some have even gone further, saying we are in political sectarianism, where people hate the opposing group more than loving their own base. And the trace of corrupt media can be found in all these stories. And that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and do join us again next time for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
The notorious Guantanamo Bay prison is a stain on the human rights record of the U.S. 20 years on, and this prison still stands as the symbol of the most disgraceful human rights abuses in the world. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. Global Times wrote, on January 11, 2002, the U.S. military began detailing captives of its global so-called war on terror at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, starting one of the longest and darkest chapters of its abusive treatment of suspects. In the years to come, hundreds of foreign Muslim men and even boys would be secretly detained, denied due process, and subjected to physical and psychological abuses, some of which amount to torture.
According to New York Times, as of July 2022, the U.S. has imprisoned 780 men and boys at Guantanamo since 9/11, many of whom were later determined to have little or no connection with Al-Qaeda. Nine have died at the facility. Although President Obama ordered its close within 1 year in 2009, 36 remain detained. Since the beginning, Guantanamo has been an arrangement that aims to circumvent both domestic and international legal supervision. To start with, a detention site located at a U.S. Navy base on foreign soil provides the convenience of complete U.S. jurisdiction and control while avoiding the unpleasantness of any domestic legal oversight. Back then, the Bush administration labeled detainees there as unlawful combatants, a newly coined term, rather than the traditional prisoners of war. This labeling tactic gives the U.S. discretion to decide how these detainees would be treated. Because the U.S., one of the 196 states that have ratified the Geneva Conventions of 1949, is bound to guarantee POWs a minimum standard of care, including safe accommodation, adequate food and medical attention, as well as immediate release and repatriation after the cessation of active hostilities. States are required by these conventions to offer the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, access to detainees and prohibited from exposing POWs to violence, torture, or cruel treatment. Unlawful combatants, a term undefined in the Geneva Conventions or any other treaties, are therefore not guaranteed the above-mentioned legal protection. With the authorization of the U.S. administration and the military, the Central Intelligence Agency, CIA, later created and subjected numerous detainees to the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques, such as beating, sleep and food deprivation, extreme noise, isolation, severe cold, sexual humiliation, stress position, mock drowning, waterboarding, and walling. For over two decades, Guantanamo Bay has been at the center of controversy. It stands as a haunting moment of human rights violations by the U.S. on the grounds of national security. Through Guantanamo, the U.S. suggests to the world that it is acceptable to sideline human rights and humane treatment of detainees in the name of countering terrorism. More than two decades on, many in the U.S. still know little of the details of the systematic abuses carried out by the CIA and U.S. military against these foreign people for reasons. To start off, successive U.S. administrations have connived at these wrongdoings and chosen to cover up this moral low ground in its so-called war on terror. Only people cleared by the Pentagon can fly to the heavily guarded base. Proceedings from Guantanamo's military commissions, a flawed system to persecute prisoners at the base, have never been publicly broadcast. And transparency requests from media and activist groups have been resisted on the grounds that non-public information is classified. The Bush administration tried to block federal courts from reviewing Guantanamo cases. In the face of mounting domestic pressure, the Obama administration reviewed the legal status of each detainee but concluded that the detainees could continue to be held under the laws of war and not treated as POWs. In 2014, the Senate Intelligence Committee only released a heavily redacted summary of its 2014 report on the CIA torture program. The current administration has no intention to release the full Senate report, much less criminally investigate those responsible for creating, authorizing, or implementing the CIA secret detention and torture program. Like the previous ones, it also opposes allowing the International Criminal Court to include abuses by U.S. nationals in its investigation on grave human rights crimes in Afghanistan. Besides, popular culture in the U.S. has often soft-pedaled and glorified the cruelty and failure of these measures. For example, the 2012 Hollywood blockbuster movie Zero Dark Thirty and the 2019 interrogation exhibit at the International Spy Museum in Washington trivialized the abuses inflicted on suspects and went so far as to suggest erroneously that torture worked. Guantanamo is hardly the only scourge from the U.S. so-called War on Terror. Its counterterrorism campaign has spread to 85 countries with scant transparency or oversight. Brown University's Cost of War project found out that with the participation of U.S. allies, the CIA secretly and extrajudicially transferred at least 119 foreign Muslims from one foreign country to another for incommunicado detention and harsh interrogation to various CIA black sites. The U.S. military also held thousands of foreign Muslim security detainees and POWs, including women and boys, at its detention centers abroad, including Abu Ghraib in Iraq and Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, subjected many to physical and psychological abuse, and denied them access to lawyers and right to challenge the basis for their imprisonment. Despite the controversy, the U.S. has continued its cruel and inhumane practices against terrorism suspects to this day, transferring them to U.S.-run sites overseas where they are subject to torture. It is deeply disheartening to see a country that has been so central to the drafting of core international human rights instruments breaking its commitments. Before Guantanamo turns 21, bold steps need to be taken to reverse the course. Truth needs to be told. Justice needs to be upheld. Wrongs need to be made right. Those responsible for terrorist attacks must be held accountable to law and serve their terms properly to atone for their crimes. So are those who have incarcerated, tortured, and killed innocent men and women, boys and girls, in the name of countering terrorism. Also, New York Times wrote, at millions per detainee, Guantanamo prison stuck in a cycle of costly delays. More than 20 years have passed since the George W. Bush administration brought the first detainees to this remote outpost in southeast Cuba 4 months after the attacks of September 11, 2001. It was a makeshift temporary mission and it is still being run that way. Expeditionary style, as the military calls it. Over the years, the Guantanamo prison has cost $7 billion and has housed 780 detainees and tens of thousands of troops on mostly year-long or shorter tours of duty. Even now, with just 36 detainees at the prison, each costs $13 million a year. When a brigadier general from the Michigan National Guards becomes the 21st commander later this year, he will inherit many of the same challenges as those who commanded before him. Moldy, unsafe buildings, an outsized prison staff, and ailing, aging detainees, some still suffering the consequences of torture in CIA prisons 2 decades ago.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran. Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.